Well, it all started as an apparent somewhat of a farce, but has undoubtedly been blown out of proportion as just under 2 million people now are signaling their intent to storm one of the most highly protected facilities in the United States. The man behind the idea to raid the secretive Area 51 and see those aliens has opened up on what will happen next in his viral campaign. His name's Matty Roberts. That's his name. He's from California. He's concerned that some overly enthusiastic fans of the alien cover-up theory from Facebook express willingness to die for the event. And he noted that he didn't want to turn the prank into a military-based slaughter and would like to see something educational, maybe music and art, on what they're doing. So, folks, I'm still recommending do not go out to Area 51. This is serious, serious stuff. In a moment, of course, Jeremy Finley with us back again. His first book was called The Darkest Time of Night. The latest, The Dark Above. Wait till you hear the story next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. Let me tell you about Jeremy Finley. Jeremy's investigative reporting has resulted in criminal convictions, hearings before the U.S. Congress, the payout of more than $1 million to victims, and the discovery of missing girls. His work has resulted in some of the highest honors in journalism, including twice winning the IRE Award, the National Edward R. Murrow Award, a National Headliner Award, and more than 16 regional Emmys and Edward R. Murrow Awards, and that's very impressive, folks. He is the chief investigative reporter at WSMV-TV in Nashville, Tennessee. He lives there with his wife and children. The Darkest Time of Night is his first novel, and of course, the one we have right now was called The Dark Above. Jeremy, welcome back. How are you?
George, it's so great to be back on with you. I, of course, like so many of your other listeners, just hear the sound of your voice and things just get exciting every time I'm on. So I'm thrilled to be here again.
Did you hear about that story of the 66-year-old photographer who apparently had been taking pictures of then JonBenet Ramsey has been arrested on child pornography? And people are now beginning to wonder if he should again be the suspect. They looked at him the first time around.
It's horrifying and it's disturbing. And when I first saw it, I had to kind of read it twice to think, am I really reading this? And I'm working on an investigation now into someone that's charged with a similar crime. And I'll tell you, George, it just doesn't get scarier than that.
No, I would love to turn you loose on that story in Colorado, Jeremy.
Absolutely.
Gosh, unbelievable. So how have you been in the last year or so?
It's been fantastic. The run for The Darkest Time of Night, the first book, has been just one of the greatest professional achievements I've ever had because of all the connections I've been able to make with people in the paranormal community and people who have just told me extraordinary stories. And I'm thrilled to be out with the sequel now, The Dark Above, released today. And it really, again, reflects so much of the research that I've done into abductions and mysterious disappearances. And it's just been incredible to hear the stories I've heard in the past year or so and to really, you know, engage with this community of people that are always looking for the truth.
These are incredible novels that you have written that I think should be turned into movies or television programs, to be sure. But they're also based a lot on real things in life, aren't they?
They are. It is interesting to tell the story of where the novels came from. They are thrillers, as you mentioned. They're fictional thrillers, but deeply rooted into the research that I've done for several years now into abductions, alien abductions. But it all started from my mother-in-law, which was an unusual source. She's a wonderful lady, very quiet, very unassuming, raised five children, including my wife. And we really didn't know too much about anything else that she had done when she was quite young. And it turned out she kind of dropped the bombshell on us, I guess it's been about 6-7 years ago, that when my father-in-law was in law school, she had to make money to make ends meet. And she was a researcher for a UFO researcher. And she was his primarily his secretary. And she would tell these incredible stories of taking these phone calls from people from all over the world, and they were scary stories and frightening stories and really disturbing stories. And she told me the fact that she had been the secretary for this professor. And at the time, all she said was he was a very well-known professor in UFO research, but she never said who he was. And but it was really fascinating to hear this person that was deeply rooted in reality and had lived this life of a very normal life to have kept this, I wouldn't say a secret, but it was just not something that she talked about very often, but that she had this really extraordinary experience with the unknown and the paranormal. And then so for her to talk about that really got the juices flowing in the idea for The Darkest Time of Night and then The Dark Above.
I'm going to guess who that professor was, because to me there was only one great professor involved in ufology that I know of, and that was J. Allen Hynek.
You win the prize, George.
Ding, 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 ding.
Ding, ding, ding. And it's interesting. So when I first started doing my research into the kind of research that was done in the 1960s, because that's where The Darkest Time of Night truly begins, and because I wanted to set my novel in the same time period that my mother-in-law was a secretary for him, but I didn't ask who the professor was, even though I very much wanted to. I didn't ask because I wanted there to be a great separation between her real life experiences and what I would write in my novels. I didn't want anyone to think, okay, this is based on my mother-in-law. Mm-hmm. What it was truly based on was her experiences, which then would launch into the thrillers. But it was only recently that, you know, I kind of was bugging her a little bit. I'm like, I'd really like to know, because I kept thinking, oh, it's got to be Hynek. It's got to be Hynek. And then, of course, she came out and confirmed it. And to me, that was just the greatest revelation, because I since, of course, read extensively about him and his research, and I watched the History Channel series on him, and read more articles that I think are more deeply rooted in what really happened. And so to think that my mother-in-law, and then through her as kind of a proxy, had that kind of connection to this legendary UFO researcher has just been one of the great revelations, I think, in the last couple of years for me.
And Jeremy, she must have seen the metamorphosis of J. Allen Hynek, where he went from a Project Blue Book consultant skeptic to a swamp gas explainer, to a believer that UFOs were extraterrestrial, forming his own study group.
Absolutely. And it was at Northwestern University where she was working for him as a secretary. And I remember, you know, she talked about it to where she said, you know, he was, you know, incredibly brilliant.
And he was an astronomer, right?
And he was in the astronomy department. She worked in the astronomy department, which he worked. And she said all the professors were incredibly kind, including Hynek, and would say that they, would get all of these really bizarre, strange calls from all over the world from people that were just, you know, desperate for help, which again formed the idea for The Darkest Time of Night. But she did, and she not only saw him do that, but then of course was familiar with his work, and when he would go on to be a consultant on Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and then of course he was an extra in the movie, which a lot of people don't realize, is that he was, is kind of like a fun aside on that, but is the person that defined truly the Close Encounter system of what how Close Encounters would be, you know, categorized, was just really fascinating for her, I think, to see. And then, of course, when the series was made on the History Channel, I think she got a really big kick out of that, knowing that she'd had this brush with this legend in the industry.
Tell me about the title of the latest book, The Dark Above.
So it's the darkest time of night for your listeners that would be interested in reading the book tells the story of the abduction of a U.S. senator's grandson. And when no one is able to find him, from the FBI to the military to the National Guard, the grandmother, the boy's grandmother, the senator's wife, has to return to her life that she has kept purposely hidden of her work as a UFO researcher, because she sees similarities what's happened to her grandson and what has happened in his case and all the cases she used to research in the 1960s. So that's The Darkest Time of Night, and it truly reflected to me to talk about the young boy disappears in the darkest time of night in some woods behind the senator's home. But it also referenced her darkest time of her life, having to look for her beloved grandson in this situation and risking so much of her own reputation to find him. When we got to the sequel, which takes place 15 years after the boy disappears, I really wanted to encapsulate the awe of what we all kind of feel when we're out in the middle of a field, away from the city lights, or out driving, and we look up and we see the vastness of what's above us. And it can either be inspiring, or I think in some cases it can be terrifying. And I really wanted to encapsulate that concept in the title, because what happens in the sequel, and I don't want to give away too much, but it is very much a kind of a roller coaster, a thrill ride, if you will, of what happens to all these people 15 years after the circumstances of the darkest time of night, when they truly have to encounter what is out there, what is terrifying in the universe, and what could possibly be happening on our planet as a result. So the idea came from my wife and I were sitting outside in our backyard, and we live close enough to downtown to where some of the light pollution from the city was up, but it was a very clear night, and I was looking up and just thinking about the vastness, and even as a child, sometimes laying outside and looking up at the stars, you kind of just get that, how you can just get lost looking up at it. And that's where the idea came from for the title, just to really encapsulate, I think, kind of that fear we sometimes feel of the vastness of space.
Jeremy, I want to get your reaction to what I'm going to read to you. It happened, of course, in 1966 in Dexter, Michigan, where Dr. J. Allen Hynek was the consultant for Project Blue Book, and he was sent there to investigate this series of strange lights that people were reporting all over the place. But listen to this part of the story. One afternoon, he spent hours looking for evidence in the Dexter Swamp, and he was accompanied by the Washtenaw County Sheriff Douglas Harvey, who led the local response to the sightings. Afterwards, on the drive back from the swamp, Hynek told the sheriff he did not have an explanation for the sightings, had no idea what they were. Later, back at the sheriff's office, Hynek apparently received a phone call from Washington, D.C. According to the sheriff, Hynek stepped out of the office, took the call, came back in a few minutes later. He looked shaken. He had his head down. He was mumbling, "Swamp gas, swamp gas." It was swamp gas. And they say, I don't think Hynek knew what swamp gas was. Is it conceivable that somebody in Washington forced Hynek to say that?
You know, I have to tell you, George, I think it absolutely is not only conceivable, it is probably the fact at the time. What I've always found fascinating about him, and you know this as a journalist and myself as an investigative journalist, is, you know, so much of what we do is pushing to not only find the truth, but to go through these barriers of people telling us, it has to be this. It can't possibly be this. It has to be this. And especially dealing with the government, there are so many times, even through just routine daily reporting, that we will be told things that is part of the spin cycle, which is, hey, you know, if we can spin it this way, then if we can convince this reporter this, then we can meld our own truth that goes out there. And so So I think that in Hynek's case, and what I just love about the guy is that here he was, and he was truly hired, as you know, and many of your listeners know, to be a complete skeptic, to disprove this. And here was this man of truth and integrity and facts. And slowly but surely, he kept getting this pushback over and over and over again, from his government officials and you know, people telling this couldn't be real. And then ultimately coming to the conclusion, I think, that so many of us do, that there has to be something to it. There has to be something. There's just too many people with too many stories that are unexplained for there not to be something to it. So I think to the root of your question, it would not surprise me, especially in that time period when there was so much concern about foreign powers and things like that, and this concern about hysteria when it would come to any type of government control or conspiracies, that it would not surprise me at all if Hynek was in a full-scale wage against people trying to hide the truth.
And then, of course, it ate away at him. That swamp gas theory just ate away at him for the rest of his life. He formed the Center for UFO Studies in Illinois, which was a huge organization to investigate UFOs. He wrote the book, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, that Steven Spielberg turned into a movie. And he was into this so much, he even had a cameo role in the film.
That's right. And I think I was telling the story that it's one of my mother-in-law's favorite things, because she, of course, recognized him, you know, when he was up briefly in the film.
With his pipe.
With his pipe, I believe he did have his pipe in that scene. And when I was doing my research for The Darkest Time of Night, the Darkest Time of Night takes place in Illinois in my fictional version of this, in a different university. But there was very much of what I was looking at, the work that he did to really, you know, fictionalize this thriller. And so it's just, like I said, just been so great to know this whole time. You know, of course, when I was doing my research, I would research Hynek and all the work that he did, but I had no idea at the time he was the professor that my mother-in-law worked for. So to know now,
oh my God,
it was just the greatest. I still to this day just get a big grin on my face, knowing that, you know, that connection was there. It's great.
It is remarkable. The name of the book is called The Dark Above, and it is just out now, Jeremy, isn't it?
It is. It's out today. It is out now. It can be purchased or anywhere across the country. What I love to tell your listeners is that the audio versions are also going to be available, and they're just these incredible audio versions by these great actors and actresses that have done this just fantastic performance. To really bring these stories to life. And I think that what I love about having books like these come out this time of year is that, you know, we're all, I think, kind of in that summer kind of mindset where, you know, we like to give our brains a little bit of a rest from our work. And you know, we're looking for something healthy that, you know, you can escape into. And if you can't escape into a movie theater for a blockbuster, I like to think that I've written something that kind of fills that equivalent, to where you can throw it in your bag and go to the beach and read it. And, you know, all of us that are fascinated by the paranormal, this is very much a pulse-pounding thriller about the paranormal and people trying to define the truth. And when you get comparisons already, we've got some really great reviews that have come in that have compared it to the X-Files and Stranger Things. And to me, that's just about as good as it gets. So I'm thrilled, and it's out today. I couldn't be more excited.
I'm in St. Louis for a couple of weeks doing a live show this weekend in Florida, so it makes the trip easier. I had a cameraman working for me when I was running a TV station here in St. Louis years ago. His name was John Finley. Any relation by any chance?
You know, it's funny. That's my father's name, but it's unfortunately not him. But he was my father was a small town veterinarian. But it's good to know there was another John Finley in the industry.
Jeremy, I want to talk about alien abductions when we come back after the break. But I also want to get your reaction to this apparent September 20th event at Area 51, where close to 2 million people are pledging that they're going to go out there and storm the place. to try to get information about UFOs. I'm trying to tell people, don't go. These folks take this area really seriously.
Yeah, no, I think it's you're giving the great advice, George, and I look forward to talking to it, because it is something that I am just, it just goes to show our fascination with this. But this could be a dangerous event, so we got some stuff to talk about.
Absolutely. Jeremy Findlay with us. His latest book is called The Dark Above. His first one was called The Darkest Time of Night. That's still available, too. His website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. It's his name. But we've got the link for you right there, and we're going to come back and talk more about alien abductions and don't go to Area 51. And welcome back. Jeremy Findlay with us, The Dark Above, his latest novel. What do you think of those Navy pilots that reported seeing the tic-tac-type objects?
Isn't that fascinating? I was,
sure
you know, of course, I have a Google alert set anytime there's type of a military report of any type of UFO sighting. And you know, it just, I think in the last year or so, there just seems to be this public appetite. It, you know, waves and it flows. And we're certainly at one of these peak times where there's so much interest in this. And I think it's become now so mainstream in the sense of the public's fascination, and it's really okay to talk about it. And you have all of these people from the military coming out and talking about what they've seen. And there's a real lack of fear, which it makes me happy to see, of people trying to describe these situations. And so that one is one that just really blew my mind. I think it blew a lot of people's minds. I think that for one of the first times in the government, lawmakers are talking about this, and it's not a joke. It's not a topic of entertainment anymore. I think people are really looking for answers, and so I think that's what we've seen in this latest incident when they talk about this, and there's these questions of what these men and women are seeing in the military. And to me, it's one of, I think it strikes to the credibility of so many of these stories when you have, and George, you and I have talked about this before, where so many of these members of the military and then just average people like you and me have nothing to gain by telling these stories, right?
There's That's nothing right. There's that nothing.
Get from this. There's no $1 million paycheck waiting for you to tell these stories. You open yourself up to this type of scrutiny. And so I really applaud the bravery of these, of any of these men and women that come forward with these stories, especially when they're in the military.
Now, of course, back to Area 51, Bob Lazar, who claimed to have worked out at that place, reversed engineered things, saw strange things. September 20th, 2 million people almost have signed up saying that they're going to storm the place. I think it's a mistake. Now, I don't think we're going to get that many people out there, but even if 10,000 people are out there, that's a problem.
Even if it's 5,000 people out there, it's a problem. I mean, the government takes their work extremely seriously at these bases. And, of course, there is always going to be this public fascination about this. But you're so right when you say this, George. You've seen it. I've seen it. They're not messing around here. The work that they do there, they are going to keep it protected for a reason. And some of the reasons we know for sure, some of them we don't know. And that's the way that these bases work. And so when I first started reading about this, I thought, well, this is pretty entertaining, right?
Yeah, it was supposed to be a joke.
It's a joke, right? You know, it's like, this is pretty funny, let's do this. And then I worry about the people that, you know, are some, you know, frame of mind, or they're just really, you know, upset with the government for one reason or the other. And they think that this is kind of a stance they can take that will get them onto the base. And as you said, George, and I've heard you say it several times before on the air, it's just a bad idea. It's just a bad idea to put yourself in harm's way. And I think the thing to harness here is that there is this interest in Area 51 and all of this knowledge that the government may or may not have. And if you really want to know this, there are so many more effective ways of trying to find it out than storming Area 51. It's just not a good idea.
Watch the government stymie them and simply say, Folks, we're going to let you on the base, but not today. We want this organized and controlled. We're not going to have a million people running all over the place. You're going to come in buses. We're going to charter them for you, and that'll diffuse it.
That would diffuse it. I don't think that day's ever going to come.
No, but everybody will still say, you're not showing us the real stuff.
Of course, right? And that's the thing that I think everybody will always say, and I think they have reason to say it, because, I mean, the government is not going to, there are just some things that the government is just not going to open up to the public to see, and, you know, it's what's made it one of the great legends of our time and stories of our time. And I don't think even I call it stories, but it is deeply rooted in fact. And you know, a lot of people have spent considerable work trying to expose what really happened there. So I get it. I get people's fascination. I have the same fascination. But I do think we have to be realists. I think we have to think about this and go about it smarter ways than storming Area 51.
Absolutely. I think primarily that base is used for military technology that is beyond anything we can even comprehend right now. Do they have reverse engineered UFOs that they have? Maybe. That's possible. But I think primarily it's a military installation. They've got high technology there, and they're not going to let a mouse go across that fence line.
They're not, and they shouldn't. I have deep, deep respect for our men and women in the military and what they have to go through to keep us safe. I'm also an investigative journalist, so I'm constantly pressing the military for answers, and usually, thanks to really brave men and women that will come forward with problems they see in the military. It's not a perfect institution, but you do have to take a lot of respect and thought when it comes to the reasons of, you know, testing whatever they have to test out there. It's one of the great debates of our time is if there is knowledge of life beyond our planet, the government has this, you know, if that knowledge comes out, what it would truly do to our world, what it would do to religion, and really everything would shift if that kind of proof came out. So I'm sure that if there's something that the government knows that we don't know, and they're guarding these secrets, that's a lot to do with it, and that's a lot to what I get into in The Dark Above, especially, is this thought of what would happen if people start believing this and there is proof of this, and what if people in the government start to realize that they too have been misled? Of course, my book is a story of fiction, but I think it is definitely an issue for us all to think about, is if this proof came out. Let's say these people stormed Area 51 and they found some kind of proof, and the ripple effect that it would have on our economy, our world, would be, I think, difficult for us to really comprehend until it happened. It would just be a game changer for everyone.
You could see pictures of the people standing by UFOs on Facebook.
You would, and you'd be like, hey, my profile picture's here with me and the alien that they did the inspection on. So, yeah, it would definitely be a game changer.
I've got to give my colleague George Knapp credit, also Jeremy, for sticking his neck out covering so many UFO stories that he has done on television.
Yeah.
He, of course, works in Las Vegas.
Right.
And, you're under a lot of criticism and fire when you deal with these stories on a regular basis.
Oh, you do. And, you know, along with my respect for the whistleblowers that come out, but also for any of the journalists or scientists that do put themselves out there, that, you know, come forward and ask these kind of questions. But again, I like to think that we have moved more into a public conscious, hopefully, of, listen, you know, I've heard you talk about it, you and I have talked about it, this whole realm of fake news and how this plagues journalists, and your listeners, I think, will understand this, is that everybody listening to this show has that desire to know the truth. And so for the men and women that go out there and really pursue that truth, whatever they're doing, if they're in the military or if they're scientists or if they're researchers or if they're journalists, and they stick their neck out to really and put their careers on the line and face this kind of scrutiny, I applaud them. I stand with them. I just got back from our yearly conference of investigative reporters and editors, and I really feel like that there was this how we're all kind of uniting in this scrutiny that we're all facing. And we all know deep down inside, I mean, nobody does this for the money. Nobody does this for the fame and glory. It's truly a passion for uncovering the truth. And so it's an interesting road for me to walk as a journalist that is deeply rooted in reality, and I can't afford to have facts wrong in my stories, to then also writing, speculative fiction that does, free me up a little bit. But, the one commonality, I think, between the two is even in my fiction, even in my novels, they will be deeply rooted in factuality and research, because I think that's what makes a great story, not only a nonfiction story, but a great fiction story. If it's real and you've got the facts to back it up, it brings that for people to trust and, I think, enjoy it a little bit more as well. So I applaud your colleague. I applaud everything he does. Every weekend he's on.
What do you think of the alien abduction situation? I know Travis Walton well. He was abducted years ago. Books written about him, movies done about him, Fire in the Sky.
Sure.
He and his logger friends passed lie detector tests.
Right.
What do you think the alien abduction phenomena is?
So, I get this question asked to me a lot because of the books, and thankfully the books have been, featured in People magazine and gotten really very kind reviews from NPR and the New York Post. And so I get this asked a lot by readers. They'll be like, well, what do you think? What do you believe? And here's where I'm at. I'm actually in a different place than I was a year ago when I first talked to you, George, when The Darkest Time of Night came out, because it was still and will always be a big skeptic, right? I mean, it's what we are. We're skeptics. But I have spoken to so many people in the past year with these extraordinary stories, and these are not people seeking fame. These are people that will come up at book signings. These are people that will write to me. One of them was a friend of my in-laws out in Florida, and these people say, look, they've got these stories that are just incredible of what they've seen, what they've encountered, what they've thought, what they've experienced, and my thought is they're not lying. And when people ask me the question, well, do you believe? And I said, well, I'll tell you this: I don't believe that people are lying.
Right.
And
same with people who see Bigfoot. I don't think they're all lying. I think most of them are telling the truth.
I think they are. I think they have seen something that they can't understand and they can't explain. And it's speaking of Hynek. His job obviously was to disprove all of this until he became a believer himself. And that's where I'm at right now, is that I believe these people.
And by the way, don't you think that story alone of J. Allen Hynek going from skeptic for the government to a believer, to the fact that he set up a study group and also, wrote books about this and became a staunch believer, and I'll tell you the case that I've been told was the one that convinced him, it's got to be one of the greatest stories out there. But the UFO case that turned him around was the late police officer Lonnie Zamora in Socorro, New Mexico, who claimed that he saw a couple aliens outside of a space capsule in the desert of New Mexico, and they got in it and took off. And that story convinced Hynek so much, he became a believer. But don't you think the Hynek story and his change is one of the greatest stories to convince people there's something going on?
Yeah, the thing that I love about his story is what you just said, George, is that he was such a skeptic. He was a hired skeptic. He was on the payroll to go out and disprove this. And this is what I tell people all the time. I said, it's great to be a skeptic. Be a skeptic. Doubt what's going on. That's the mindset we should all be. We should all be critical thinkers about all of this.
He may have been a believer, but a paid actor by the government.
Right. But I, you know, I've read a lot about him, and I really do think he was an academic. He was an academic that truly was here to analyze and to look at all of this and really struggled with it, right? I think that was one thing that I've taken away from everything I've read about him, is he really struggled with this. Even after he came out and really talked about being a believer himself, I think that is the great story of his life, and what should be a lesson for all of us is to be this skeptic, doubt this, but then you got to keep an open mind. And when I, and again, you know, people will come up and tell me their stories, and they have nothing to gain. They don't want any attention. They don't want me to write about it. They don't want me to broadcast about it. They just want to say, this is what happened to me. This is what I saw. And so I believe the people, and that's where I stand. I believe them.
Are you hearing more and more reports, Jeremy, of these hybrid programs?
You know, I've read a lot about it. I try to really, like, there was an advertisement for MUFON
right before,
and you know, those guys are pros. I spent so much of my time doing research on them, and especially their work in the 1960s, and because I am far from being an expert on this, just someone that is fascinated by it and uses that research to write novels. I tend to look to them for answers about this, to where to what they have found out and what they've been looking into. You know, I always refer back to them, but it's interesting, and I do hear a lot about it. I hear you know, people talk about it, and I hear people tell stories of it, and it's really just, you know, fascinating. And I think it's part of my job as a journalist just to listen, right? That is a huge part of what I do, is just to listen to people's stories and not pass judgment. So yeah, I think people talk about it. I think that there, again, as we've talked about in the last hour or so, there's this fascination with it, and you know, people just they want to talk, and they want to be able to have their voices heard, and I think that's one of the great things about our time, is that you can share this. And I just ask, you know, your listeners, and I ask people to just keep an open mind. And you know, if don't dismiss someone that they're crazy just because they have had an experience that they can't explain. I think that's one of the great mysteries of our time.
Are you getting information from whistleblowers because they know you're an investigative reporter?
So I get a lot of military people will reach out to me. I just got one when I checked my email right before the show. An investigator, they must have seen that I was coming on the show, and said that he wanted to talk to me about some occurrences in Florida. And, you know, but I'm also very honest with people when I talk to them. I say, look, you know, my work as a journalist is completely different than my work as a novelist, right? If you tell me a story of what's happening in the paranormal field or anything about abductions, I'm willing to listen. I love to talk about it. I love to talk to people about it. But you know, I work for a very hard news, serious.
And you can tell by your awards. We're going to come back with more in a moment. Your calls with Jeremy Finley next.